Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Margaret Wakely. Wakely is a singer, voiceover artist, and the community development coordinator for gratefulness.org. It's a worldwide community dedicated to gratefulness as a core inspiration for personal change, international cooperation, and sustainable activism in areas of universal concern. Wakely has also performed in clubs and hotels throughout the U.S. and Europe, and her most recent CD is a collection of contemporary and classic songs called Perfect Strangers. And welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I want to begin with the beginning, because you plan to become a social worker, and you even got a degree in psychology, and you segued into entertainment. Why?
That's where I got my first job. Well, actually, it was concurrent. My first job out of college was in a little psychiatric center in Atlanta, Georgia, but I had moved down there with a friend of mine who was bound and determined to make it as a singer in the music business. So we had a little duo together, and we started singing on the side. And then after about 9 months, I said, I think I'll maybe be a social worker later on in life, and I'll try this now.
Really? So yeah. You got so taken by it.
Yeah. I mean, I had been singing all my life, but not professionally singing. I never even thought of it as a career. It wasn't in my vision. But we started doing it thanks to my friend Betsy Bogart, and I haven't really stopped ever since. Well, I've sort of taken breaks, but...
Yeah. Well, did your family support you in this, or were they scared? Because entertainment is often such an iffy business.
Yeah. Well, my mom died when I was 9. She was the musical one, and she probably would have supported me. My dad was kind of the silent, supportive type, and I believe he was kind of scared, but he just let me do what I wanted to do, which was really nice of him.
That's great. It's great to have the freedom to either fly or fall.
Yeah.
Whatever happens. So you also took piano lessons for 12 years. Did you get caught into the passion of that as well?
Well, you know, not really. I mean, I took classical lessons, but I remember a time when something kind of clicked in my mind when my teacher also taught me how to take a piece of sheet music, like a popular song, and look at the little chord chart above the notes. And he taught me how to play the melody with my right hand and do like arpeggios with the left hand, just looking at those chords. And I went, oh, this opens up a whole new world.
Ah,
so that was good.
So you got the creative aspect of that. Did you ever play piano as a performer? I've never seen it on your CDs.
My whole career as a solo entertainer, I accompanied myself with piano and guitar.
So when you're live?
Before I started becoming a cabaret singer, before I stopped doing music for a living, and I was doing a fundraiser actually for a Unitarian church in Seattle, when they said, we have these, you know, I'd love to have our accompanist accompany you, and I said, well, that would be fun. So that was the first time I ever tried singing without playing an instrument, and I said, this is much better accompaniment than what I could ever do.
Ah.
So I kind of switched at that time.
And did you have to change your performing style when you did that too? You obviously had to become more of an actress maybe, when you didn't have the piano to...
Yeah, I had to figure out what to do with my hands. And I remember seeing a videotape of myself for the first time, and it looked like I was flying or something. My arms were all over the place, and I learned to kind of keep a little quieter with that. But the acting part, I think that came about when I was a solo entertainer and I was trying to cover up my sort of plain accompaniment by really drawing people in by the story of the song, by the melody and the words. And I always liked talking about the songs I was doing, and I always loved kind of making up a narrative between songs too. So I did that to take focus away from my piano playing.
Uh-huh. And, well, your biography says that you found opportunities early on singing and acting. What kind of acting were you actually doing? Were you doing musicals?
No, not... You mean in my, like, growing up?
Yeah, well, in your biography it says you found singing and acting opportunities early on, and I was wondering what that meant.
Well, I don't remember writing that, but it must have been my biographer. For a brief time in Los Angeles, I mean, I took acting lessons and uh-huh. studied with a teacher and won some kind of a contest with that, and I used that to get an agent, an on-camera agent. I already had a voiceover agent. So I was kind of starting off in that kind of a new career for me when I met my husband and left town and had babies. So uh-huh. that was sort of curtailed.
Yeah. Well, being a cabaret singer is kind of an act. It's a performance. It's not just standing there singing like solo. You do have to know how to act in some ways.
Yeah.
Act the part of the cabaret singer, perhaps.
Right, or just kind of get into the story of the song and get that message across. And I guess I've always been expressive, so that was kind of a natural way for me to go doing the cabaret.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that singers standing there alone on the stage are trying to interpret songs. They just think of the voice and the song, but you're actually trying to act out and portray a story.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what's so great about cabaret singers. It seems like such an old-fashioned notion now.
Yeah.
But I absolutely love it. I love cabaret singers. Now, as you just mentioned, you got married and you had two sons. How did having children change you as a performer or enrich you? Or how did it affect you?
Well, as I said, I really stopped working as an independent musician and started collaborating mainly on fundraising events and singing with other people and getting more into this cabaret or singing with jazz accompanists. So that really helped me grow as a singer because I got to explore much different repertoire than what I could do on my own, which was more kind of folk pop oriented. Mm-hmm. And I really loved singing again. When I was working, making a living at it, which I now, you know, I'm very grateful for having that opportunity to do so, it really wasn't that much fun because it was mostly background music in clubs and hotels and restaurants, and that's why I went into voiceovers. I got totally depressed doing that. So when I had a family and was just singing for special events, the whole love of singing came back to me again.
Ah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so having children sort of reawakened something in you.
Yeah, it did. And they're both really musical, too, so it was fun having them grow up and introducing them. Both my husband and I introduced them to a whole range of music when they were growing up.
Oh, that's great. So they've gone on the journey with you.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah,
some people keep the family totally separate, you know. But it sounds like the kids have been involved in your career in many ways. Tell us about the influence of Barbra Streisand. I didn't realize that Barbra Streisand was such a big influence until you did the Hanger Theater tribute.
Well, as a teen, I was introduced to her by my brother gave me one of her albums when I was like 14. And the music that she sang back then were old standards or show tunes from then or from a little bit earlier. That's what my mother used to sing when she'd sit at the piano and play songs and sing. And I loved that music, and her voice to me was this revelation. So I always loved that, but I didn't really sing it when I was, you know, in my early professional years because I wasn't really able to accompany myself well to play those songs. So I sort of left that. But I tell you, preparing for this cabaret that I did at the Hanger Theater, I barely had to memorize any words for that because they were all just still in my brain from those early...
That's what happens when you memorize things young. I have all these poems that I still remember from when I was a teen, and I'm thinking, why?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I'll never forget the time my parents were getting all dressed up and getting ready to go to San Francisco, and we're going, where are you going? And they said they heard about this new young singer named Barbra Streisand, and they were going to go listen to her for one of the first times.
Wow.
It was so exciting to look back and think, my God, how did they know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really exciting.
You know, when I was thinking about this show at the Hanger and what to do, I started looking into songwriters and trying to do maybe a whole evening of the same songwriter, and I didn't feel that I was so involved with those songs. They didn't really touch me. I said, I really love doing poignant songs and really funny songs and upbeat songs and a range of different songs. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking about that's what her choice of music was like.
Oh, absolutely.
And especially in those early days. Those are the ones that
She did a lot of quirky songs, too.
Yeah.
A lot of odd songs.
Yeah.
That fit her personality, of course.
Yeah,
We finally discovered.
That's right.
But let us play something from your new CD called Perfect Strangers. This one's called Under Paris Skies. Can you tell us what attracted you to this piece?
I needed a bookend piece for the other song that goes with this, The Perfect Stranger that goes along with it, which is by Dave Frischberg called Another Song About Paris. Uh-huh. So I wanted to find a very kind of typical song that really sounded like all the songs about Paris. That's why I chose this one.
Okay, well, let's listen to a bit of it.
Stranger, beware, there's love in the air under Paris skies. Try to be smart and don't let your heart catch on fire. king the moment it spring under Paris skies. Lonely hearts meet somewhere on the street of desire. Parisian love can bloom high in a skylight room, or in a gay cafe where hundreds of people can see. I wasn't smart and I lost.
I just love this song. It just reminds me of, you know, my trips to Europe. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now tell us about the creation of this whole CD. Is there a theme? Because you have songs matching each other or complementing each other. Tell us how this metamorphosized.
Well, I had done this before in the show where I'd sing a song and I go, oh, that song just reminds me of another one. And I decided to do a whole album of songs that weren't meant to go together, but they seemed to speak to each other.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a really fun project. I could have gone on and on. I did a lot of songs on this album. It's probably too many, 16 or something on that album.
No, I don't think it's too many. No, you get into the theme.
Yeah.
The songs almost speaking to each other.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I love that. So it was fun to do.
Yeah. How did you do the research? A lot of these songs I've never heard.
I think that I had sung a lot of them. They were already in my repertoire. I don't know. I've got a lot of song books, and I listen to different recordings, and I don't know how I came up with them. I think a lot of them I was already familiar with.
Uh-huh. Because, I wasn't, and I was thinking she must have done some research, because these aren't as famous as some of the standards that one hears, at least not to my ears.
Right. You know, I always looked for the more obscure songs that touched my heart, and one of my jobs I had when I was a solo entertainer was 2 months in Sweden and 1 month in Finland, and I worked at these three different hotels, and my repertoire, which was that, was kind of obscure, what I thought were really great, thoughtful, interesting songs. It was the worst repertoire over there. It just didn't match at all. I was miserable. They needed the standards. You know, they didn't need obscure American songs.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can understand that. Because, I mean, some of them are slow, and you really have to listen intently to get what the story is.
Yeah.
Well, talk to us about voiceover work. How did you get into doing voiceovers?
Well, when I was in Los Angeles, I did a couple commercials. Somebody just got in touch with me to do political commercials or whatever, and I was looking for something else to do besides singing for a living.
Mm.
And I had this idea to do voiceovers, and I joined a workshop, and the teacher eventually made a demo in that workshop and right away got an agent in Los Angeles. And then I took acting classes in order to just become a better actress to do voiceover work.
Mm-hmm.
That's about it. I just loved doing it. I didn't really do too much in Los Angeles because I moved to Seattle shortly thereafter. I did a little bit in Seattle, and then when I came here, I started actually doing a really fun thing that I auditioned for Will Russell. He was hired to do these English TOEFL and TOEIC lessons for Korean public radio.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that was so much fun. There would always be a cast of four of us, two men and two women, doing that. So we did that for like a year and a half. It was a lot of fun.
Wow, that's interesting. So you know, when you come in to do a voiceover, do you have a bank voice or a voice for public service announcements that are maybe about health issues? Do you have different voices?
Well, I do try out different things. If it needs to be lighter, I'm lighter and I put more of a smile in my voice. If it needs to be more educational and serious, I can be that way. I don't do a lot of character voices.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly kind of a modulation of my own voice.
Yeah. Oh, you're great at voiceovers. I don't know how to do them. And I did a lot of funny voices when I did voiceovers. But it seems to me that you really know how to act to be able to do some of these voices convincingly.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, I try. But it seems like you'd be a great voiceover actor.
But I'm hard doing straight. It's hard for me to do straight stuff.
Uh-huh. Oh,
you know,
I see.
Like a bank commercial or something. I don't have the right voice for that for some reason. I want to ask you this, too. Do you ever turn down a job because of political issues? I mean, would you do a voiceover about fracking or about a candidate that you wouldn't agree
with?
I
would not do that.
I
would turn some down.
Yeah. Have you ever had to?
No. And that very first political one that I did in Los Angeles, I can't remember who it was for, but I probably shouldn't have done that. I kind of have that memory that wasn't a great idea. Yeah, I would feel absolutely fine about turning something down.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I was wondering if people do that, because you see people on TV. You think, do they believe in that issue?
Yeah.
Well, that's the way commercials are anyway.
Yeah.
You know, for most people, it probably is just an acting job.
Right.
And have you ever thought about going into straight acting? Have you ever thought about doing legit theater?
You know, I did. When I got this agent in Los Angeles, I had a little glimpse into that. But I tell you, the first audition that I went on to was so scary and nerve-wracking. I said, I don't know if I have the guts to do this. Really, putting yourself out there as an, you know, a visible actor. I mean, I could be like I was in a Hangar Theater production as one of the chorus. You know, that was fine. But I don't know. Maybe sometime down the road they need an old lady to do something.
What do you think the difference is, though? Because I would think you'd be afraid to get out in front of audiences. It's not stage fright.
Actors, when you're studying acting, I mean, you like have to turn yourself inside out. It's a very vulnerable thing. Now, being on stage and doing cabaret singing, it's me, and I do get nervous, but I don't know. It just doesn't seem to me as risky as being an actor. I really admire actors.
Yeah, you do have to sort of tear yourself inside out or upside down or every which way to find parts of yourself to portray someone else. Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Margaret Wakely. She's a singer and voiceover artist. And we're going to talk about an organization that she's involved in, too. Let's talk about gratefulness.org. Tell us about it.
Well, it is this unusual oasis on the Internet. 11 years ago, Brother David Steindl-Rast, who is a Benedictine monk and teacher and writer, and met a young man, Daniel Yuvanovic, who is a real kind of a techie. And Daniel said to him, Brother David, you should make a website for your writings and your teachings. And Brother David said, well, what's a website? And when he found out what that was about, he goes, oh, well, I mean, that's really interesting. Could we? And he asked a couple questions, and he got a grant from Fetzer based on these two questions. Can I create a sacred space on the Internet? And can I create community around this idea of grateful living as a spiritual practice? So they got the grant. This woman by the name of Linda Fisher came on board, and she's a wonderful designer, and they designed this simple website to begin with. And one of the first features they designed is called Light a Candle, and it's a very beautiful, universal ritual of lighting a candle. You're invited into this kind of dark place, and you can write a message, a prayer, or an intention. You don't have to write anything down. But then after you've done that, you click on this wick, and it starts flickering. And it's programmed to get shorter and shorter over 48 hours until it disappears.
Wow.
And it's the introduction to it is a very universal, calming, meditative process that would appeal to anybody, no matter what your religion or lack thereof is. Mm-hmm. So shortly thereafter, 9/11 happened, and word of mouth just kind of picked up on the existence of this light a candle feature, and it really took off. And that was 11 years ago, and we've now passed the 11 millionth candle having been lit.
Wow,
and the website is visited by over 10,000 people a day, between 10,000 and 11,000 people a day from over 240 countries and territories all over the world. And people come for healing, they come for inspiration, they come for tools to help in their own personal lives or in their workplace, or helping them, you know, just discover a spiritual practice or an addition to whatever they practice.
Mm-hmm. And what's your position in this organization?
I'm kind of the jack of all trades. I do everything from development, which I hadn't really done much before, fundraising and helping in events, to I'm a designer. One of our most popular features is our free e-cards that anybody can send, and I design those e-cards. I design things like our annual report and maybe promotional cards or postcards that are written out. I help a long distance with Brother David with his engagements. He gets invitations from all over the world. Mm-hmm. I collect grateful news every month. We have a little section of several news articles that are online that are really good things to read about.
Yeah, I think people are in the mood for you know, the paper came out here called Positive News, and I think people were ready for something besides war and horror and human cruelty.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Why did you get attracted to this? Did you get attracted to it as somebody who was taking part in the offerings before you got on board?
This was like a miracle. I was looking for a job, had been recently divorced, and needed to find a job to really support myself and help support my kids. And I was applying to Cornell and Ithaca College and just started my own business. That didn't work out. So I was sitting at home, ready to go on an interview, and at the computer working, and Patricia Carlson came over to pick up her son, who was there visiting my son. She goes, you're looking for a job? And can I sit down and see what your computer skills are? And sat down. It turns out they were just going through a reorganization of a network for Grateful Living, which is the organization that gratefulness.org is part of. And she was becoming the executive director, and they needed somebody to do what she had been doing. So she said, you'd be perfect. I don't know how she knew that. She just had this intuition. So the next week, I didn't get the job at Cornell, and they offered me the job at gratefulness.org.
Wow.
So I plunged in. I had been practicing gratefulness by writing down several things I was grateful for every night. I had been doing that months before, and it had really helped me through my crisis, turned me back into the glass-half-full woman that I had been before. Mm-hmm. And it's just been one amazing learning experience after another, and so fulfilling a job.
Oh, that's great. Well, how does gratefulness.org deal with people who really are in crisis, though? I mean, do you have a network of people you can pass them along to?
Yeah, well, we do. In fact, I'm the one who gets all the mail that comes in, and people can write in and say, ask a question about gratefulness. And many times there'll be people with really serious psychological issues or spiritual issues, and I usually do not answer those. Mm. Patricia answers some. We do have wonderful mentors and advisors that work with us from all different faiths and areas, and I can ask them to answer these kind of questions. And then they end up in a section called Q&A or Q-Box. I think it's on our website. Mm-hmm. So one of the main things I learned in this job was how to be resourceful, how to listen, and then how to be really resourceful and kind of help lead people, know that they're heard, and try and lead them to help.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great service, because I do think, you know, even though everybody's connected and constantly talking and constantly online, I think more and more people are isolated.
Yeah.
You hear about, you know, suicides and all kinds of people who are lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And we think everybody's constantly engaged, but I think it's less so. And I think this website that you're talking about and this organization proves it.
Yeah.
People need to be able to connect.
Yes, they do.
Well, before we run out of time, I want to play another excerpt from Perfect Strangers. This one's called When Autumn Comes. I thought it was a perfect song for now. Mm. But tell us what got you to want to record this.
You know, I think maybe I was doing a little research with that, because I wanted to do the one about spring that comes right after You Must Believe in Spring. I heard this... Oh, I'm trying to remember what album I heard it on. I can't remember where I heard it. But I really loved it. I mean, I can't, it's no deeper than that. I hear a song with a gorgeous lyric and a beautiful melody, and I usually can't resist. This was beautiful.
Let's listen to it, When Autumn Comes. It is a beautiful song. I can understand why you're attracted to it. Now, in general, can you tell us what you look for in a song? Tell us what attracts you to songs in general.
You know, the meaning. It can be deep meaning. I mean, I love more than anything if people are moved when they hear a song and remember things in their own life and brings up feelings that they might not have been feeling or addressing and moves them in some way. So songs that are like that. And then I love humorous songs. And to me, there aren't that many really kind of sophisticated, really funny songs. They're treasures when you find them. And I always try and add some of those to mm-hmm. my shows, whatever I do.
Yeah, that must make it really nice for live shows, too, to put some humor
yeah.
in.
Yeah.
Because I notice on this album, a lot of the songs are kind of thoughtful. You don't have any jazzy tunes in this,
right.
you know what I mean? So I was wondering if you were attracted to those kinds of songs for a reason.
I don't know. They're just beautiful. And I love listening to the more up-tempo songs. I think I pull off slower songs, more quirky songs, better than really fast ones. It was nice, though, with the Barbra Streisand show, that I didn't have to worry about, oh, I've got to get another up-tempo song. There were plenty to choose from that I really enjoyed
uh-huh.
singing.
Uh-huh. And I wanted to ask you this, too. I talk to a lot of people who are folk singers and in the folk tradition, and, of course, that tradition has a lot of political and social songs. Mm-hmm. Do you ever think in terms of political and social songs, or do you think of yourself as purely an entertainer and for entertainment?
Well, I think it's different from entertainment. It's like connection. It's like heart-to-heart connection. And I just haven't gotten into being a political singer.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was a song that moved me, and if there was an issue that I was really concerned about, and there was a song that matched it, I would do it in a heartbeat. And yeah. again, it would be connecting hearts to heart about that issue.
Mm-hmm. And you're trying to connect heart to heart even when you're in the studio or when you're performing live.
Yeah.
You're trying to connect with people, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what cabaret singers
yeah.
are supposed to be doing.
I think that's why I also like the gratefulness work so much. It's really the same motivation moves all the things that I do.
You also have worked for hospice.
Yeah.
So tell us what got you into hospice.
I was with my father when he died with my siblings. He wasn't in hospice care, but he was in a very hospice-like wing of a hospital in New Hampshire. And I lived close by to our hospice center here, and every time I passed by, I felt this kind of pull over there. So I decided to go in and sign up for the training to be a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And I just loved it mm-hmm. so much.
Did you sing to people?
I did.
That's what I would think.
Yeah. I mean, I mostly made breakfast for people on Saturday morning. But one time I was asked to come in to sing to a man who didn't have family there. And I sang to him, and I didn't realize that he was actively dying. And while I was singing to him, he took his last breath. I remember singing
wow.
on a clear day to him and
oh
watching
God.
Him intently. And then I noticed he didn't take another breath, and I quietly left the room and got the nurse and found out.
That must have been an amazing experience.
It was.
Absolutely amazing
yeah.
experience.
I hadn't thought about it in a long time. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, what next? Are we going to be able to see you perform? Any more live gigs?
I would love to do this show again, since it took me months to prepare it. So I'm looking around for other venues that my band, Molly McMillan, and Doug Robinson, Brian Earle, could go with me and do it again. So I hope to do that.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking beyond that. I'm busy with my other work, but...
Yeah, well, we
to.
Hope to see you. I'd like to catch that show.
Thank you.
You want to give some contact information?
I do have a website, margaretwakely.com, and you can email me at mewakely@twcny.rr.com.
Okay.
Well, I welcome that.
Well, Margaret Wakely, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.